Welcome to Dr. Dark After Dark, number 46, Marty Bent on Bitcoin and its non-obvious ramifications. So Marty is a very well-known Bitcoiner. He's the host of Tales from the Crypt, which is one of my very favorite Bitcoin podcasts. Also the writer of Marty's Bent, which is a daily newsletter on Bitcoin, which has been going for several years. He's also the director of business development at Great American Mining, and I'm sure that's going to come up later. And I'm excited on this one because Marty's an extremely original thinker, but he's also a skeptic. He doesn't just blindly believe everything. He's very happy to point out flaws in something like Bitcoin or indeed other coins, and not just to kind of assume everything's perfect. And I think the industry needs, you know, more of people like that. And so this kind of all started when I kind of tweeted kind of deliberately controversially that the oil and gas industry would need Bitcoin to survive in 10 years' time. And it was a bit tongue-in-cheek, but I wanted to see how people reacted. And I think it was Bitcoin Tina that said, oh, Marty's really the expert on this and a leading thinker. And before you know it, in a way, kind of only Twitter can really do it, Marty was game to do a podcast. So, you know, we didn't know each other before. So, Marty, welcome. How's it going?
Going great. Thank you for having me, Chris. Don't know if I'm an expert in this field, but I am learning a lot, as you know, with anything in Bitcoin. It's hard to become an expert because there's just so much to know.
Right. But also when it comes to, when we talk, well, one part, when we talk about the oil and gas stuff, then I don't think anyone's really an expert because it's so new. So,
yeah. Yeah. It's so raw. There's so much going on, so much potential there. There's so much to learn. It's exciting.
Cool. So why don't we start with a quick intro about yourself? A lot of listeners know you already, but some of them won't. You know, how'd you first get into stuff like Bitcoin? What's kind of a quick story?
Yeah, so I found Bitcoin in, I think, around 2012, 2013, while I was studying economics in college at Chicago. I went to DePaul University. And while I was in college, I believe summer, junior into senior year, I started working at a managed futures fund as an analyst. And kept that job after I graduated. And while I was there as an analyst, we basically indexed commodity traders, advisors into a fund of funds. So I did due diligence of the funds that we invested in and in the markets they traded. And so it was a lot of commodities markets and currency markets. And so having to write our commentaries, I was forced to follow central bank tea leaves and their policies. So I was learning about Bitcoin and working at this managed futures fund and sort of seeing the juxtaposition of what was going on in Bitcoin versus what at the time Janet Yellen and the Fed were doing with their monetary policy, and noticed that the Fed would set these targets they would hit, they would never hit them, they'd miss them, they seemed to not really understand the ramifications of their policy. And so that really opened my mind to an alternative monetary system like the Bitcoin network. And so I've been pretty much very intensely studying Bitcoin for the last seven years, almost 8 years now. And I left finance in, I believe, 2015 to learn more about tech. So I took a digital design bootcamp to learn more about front-end development and UX design. And then worked at a software development company for a few years to learn more about backend infrastructure to understand the whole tech stack, and started writing about Bitcoin, like you mentioned, Marty's Bent in 2017. Started the podcast shortly after starting to write the Bent, and all this has taken on a life of its own where I'm able to write and speak about Bitcoin as well as work for this incredibly innovative company, Great American Mining, where I think what we're doing is on the cutting edge of combining the Bitcoin mining industry and the energy sector, particularly here in the United States.
Cool. And look, it might shock you since you've left finance, but the Fed still don't know what they're doing.
Doesn't shock me. Even though I've left, I've
not just the Fed, every central banker. I wonder if any central bankers listen to this. It would be cool if they did, but. I've had one on. I've had Danny Blanchflower on, who was on the MPC, and it's the UK Fed about 12 years ago. And he was always the guy that dissented on every meeting. It was kind of hilarious.
There's a few of those dissenters, and I'm happy they exist.
Exactly. Cool. So, all right, let's get into it. So, look, there's lots of let's just say Bitcoin skeptics, whatever we want to call them. I don't want to get into no coiners and stuff, doesn't really matter, but a lot of them will say, well, look, it's just internet magic money, like whatever. So what are some of the kind of non-obvious things that and ramifications of Bitcoin if it continues to grow and thrive? You know, not the stuff that's not kind of talked about every single day.
Well, I don't want to be selfish here because this plays into my self-interest with Great American Mind, but I truly believe it's not obvious. And I think it's obvious that this is not obvious due to the narratives of the public around it, but Bitcoin's energy consumption, it's a bit non-obvious that the amount of energy that Bitcoin is consuming is actually a good thing for many reasons. We'll get to the types of energy that Bitcoin's consuming in a bit, but first, just the fact that Bitcoin uses a proof of work consensus mechanism to basically create this distributed consensus and allow disparate individuals who have no idea about each other in different parts of the world to coordinate is an extremely powerful innovation. You're basically melding the physical and the digital worlds together. You're creating a digital token that is very closely tied to the physical world because it consumed a lot of energy to produce the hash, to produce the block that brought those Bitcoins to the market. So this is a bit of a non-obvious thing that people don't really grasp until they think about it for quite a while, is that Bitcoin, the protocol, is extremely innovative because it melds the digital and the physical world together. It creates this digital token by expending energy in the physical world, which is pretty mind-blowing when you think about the ramifications moving forward and the incentives that type of system creates for a more energy efficient planet, for more stable grids, for more, I don't want to say equitable, but a freer world with access to this open monetary system if you have access to energy, which is pretty powerful, especially when you compare it to the current monetary system that rules the world with the central banks like the Fed, the Bank of Japan, Bank of England, ECB, People's Bank of China. The access to the distribution and the creation of money via those monetary systems is very limited to a select few people. But with Bitcoin, if you have access to raw energy and a Bitcoin mining ASIC, you can access the new monetary system and actually contribute to it and help distribute the money created by it, which is pretty powerful. You're moving that from a very select few centralized, arguably corrupt or maybe not corrupt, but with perverse incentives, a select few powerful people around the world, and you're opening that up to any individual so willing to purchase hardware and plug it in.
Right. And so, I mean, in effect, it's just another thing that's basically decentralizing or getting more and more decentralized. And so you alluded to, you know, with the with Great American Mining. So, I mean, what I was getting at in the tweet I mentioned at the beginning was obviously, well, I guess I'm saying it's obvious, it might not be obvious, but there's a huge amount of energy wasted in oil and gas industry, especially when people flare off gas, and that happens a lot all over the world. And so how are you guys trying to solve that? Can this be really meaningful for the oil and gas industry? Like, are the economics enough that it could actually put a meaningful impact in their P&L? And I mean, I've got tons of questions on this, so but maybe just give a quick overview of what Great American Mining does.
Yes, so it's very early days. We do believe that at scale, it will be able to have an impactful, positive impact on P&L. But to take a step back and explain what we do, so we mine Bitcoin in the simplest form, Great American Mining. We started our journey about 3 years ago. We spun out of an ad tech company called Buy Sell Ads that started accumulating Bitcoin by accepting Bitcoin as payment on behalf of publishers in 2014. And so during the 2017 bull run, we had a bunch of Bitcoin on our balance sheet. I wasn't working at BSA at the time. I came on later to help with Great American Mining, but basically got to a point in 2017 when the bull market happened. Buy-sell ads had a bunch of Bitcoin on its balance sheet, saw the incredible appreciation of that particular line on the balance sheet, and our CEO Todd said, "Wow, I want to get more into this Bitcoin stuff." So decided to get into mining, and that's when Great American Mining started. And what you come to find when you start a Bitcoin mining company is that you are on a search for the lowest cost of power production that you can possibly find at scale. So you're looking for very low cost energy production and an abundant amount of it. And here in the United States, with our shale oil industry, an opportunity that presents itself, an opportunity for cheap and abundant energy that presents itself is the stranded and waste gas situation here. So when you poke a hole in the earth, when you drill a well pad to get oil out, particularly in the Bakken, in the Permian here in the United States, oil is not the only thing that comes out. You have a bunch of gas that comes out as well, nuisance gas, and that either gets vented, flared. Sometimes producers will connect to a pipeline that'll send that natural gas to market, depending on what the BTU content is and the amount of scrubbing you need to do. Another alternative that exists is natural gas liquids. We can show up with a compressor and turn that natural gas into a liquid and try to deliver that to market. But all those alternatives, well, those two alternatives, particularly building a pipeline and natural gas liquids, aren't as profitable. Natural gas, because it is so abundant, the prices have been pretty depressed for quite a while. So it's hard for producers to justify building those alternatives to get that gas to market. Just simply not profitable enough. But another problem arises where, obviously, with the climate change narrative getting stronger and people being more worried about that, regulations are getting stricter. Where we operate predominantly in North Dakota, there's a limit to the amount of flaring each producer can do. After you flare a certain amount, you have to shut down your oil production. And so in North Dakota specifically, producers are highly incentivized to flare as little as possible. So a solution like ours works out very well. So to take another step back, at Great American Mining, we have a thesis that there's a budding symbiotic relationship between the oil and gas industry and the Bitcoin mining industry. Again, we are on the search for low-cost power production, and they have this gas problem where they need to get rid of this gas. They can't flare it as much anymore. They're not making any money. They send it to market. So this is like a huge problem that they need to fix. And luckily for us, it works out well because we can show up to the source. We can show up in the middle of a oil field in the middle of nowhere, and we can just bring a couple generators, a shipping container filled with our miners, plug that in, and get a satellite on top of the shipping container, and we're able to start mining Bitcoin and consuming that gas so they can reduce their flare. Or there's many avenues which we can engage. So we like to say at Great American Mining, we would consume wasted gas in the form of flared or vented gas, stranded gas in the form of gas that simply can't get to a pipeline, or undervalued gas, which is gas that may be selling to market but could possibly make more money if that were to get to flow through generators that are powering Bitcoin mining hardware that was mining Bitcoin. So in short, the oil and gas industry has a huge problem with the gas that they produce when they drill oil well pads, and we have an incentive to drive our cost of power production as low as possible. And so this is a great opportunity for us to mine Bitcoin cheaply and for these producers to reduce their waste.
Cool. So, okay. So let's say I'm a CEO of an oil and gas rig, just a typical one in, did you say, was it Nebraska or?
North Dakota.
North Dakota. Sorry. I'm stupid. North Dakota. Okay, cool. And so, okay. So I think I want to have a go. What are the things that matter? I mean, I'm thinking like the kind of the temperature, the amount of air conditioning that's needed, like if it's boiling hot outside, it must be a little bit less economic. The quality of the gas, like, or can you just rock up and literally just hook up a 40-foot container to and a generator and just show them how it works? Because I mean, one thing I always thought was cool was using 40-foot containers, which are being used across the basically the kind of next generation farming, like farm tech as well, to have, you know, vertical farms in cities. These things are portable, so you can put them anywhere easily, and it's a really interesting way of scaling. But you know, I mean, how quickly could I be up and running? What do you need to kind of know in order to work out how economic it could be?
Yeah, a very good question. So usually when we engage with a producer, we can get up and running from the time they say, hey, all right, we're ready to do this, to being plugged in on the field within 6 weeks. Again, this is very modular. We design and build everything in-house. And yeah, so from the go-ahead to when the machines are actually plugged in is about 6 weeks. And the things you have to take into consideration for each particular well pad is, yes, the BTU content of the gas. The higher the BTU content, the wetter it is, and the more scrubbing you need to do and more treatment that needs to come with the gas. So we definitely do screen to make sure we're comfortable working with the particular gas that we are and the particular BTU content it comes with. But we have worked with pretty dirty gas, quote unquote dirty gas, over the last year, and it still works pretty well if you're able to drop some of the liquids and scrub before running it through your generator. Depending on the particular producer, they'd be willing to help you out with that, or they'd be like, hey, figure out how to do it yourself. That's one thing we love about the oil and gas industry, and we actually think, again, it plays into the symbiotic relationship, is the oil and gas industry and the Bitcoin mining industry specifically both represent ruthless capitalism. So you see a bunch of different solutions throughout the industry, and the different regulatory frameworks that exist from state to state make different producers in different states act differently. So we're learning a lot about particular producers in particular states. But yeah, BTU content, number one. Number two, MCFD. So just how much gas is flowing from a particular pad, usually between 180 and 250. If you have a BTU content around 13 to 1500, that's around 1 megawatt of consumable energy for our operation. So we could plug in a container with miners that would consume 1 megawatt of energy between 180 and 210 MCFD per day. So it's another thing that we take into consideration. Like you mentioned, these oil fields are spread out across the country and in different climates. So right now, predominantly where we're focused is North Dakota and West Texas. North Dakota obviously gets extremely cold, and West Texas gets extremely hot. And so that's one thing we really pride ourselves at Great American Mining specifically, is that we have a head engineer who has a chemical engineering and a petroleum engineering dual degree. He's worked in the oil and gas industry extensively throughout his career, worked at the EPA for a while as well. And he really understands the intricacies of the type of gas that we're working with and the environments that gas is being pulled out of the ground in. So we design our containers to spec depending on where they're going to go. So in North Dakota, we have an air-cooled unit due to the fact that it doesn't get crazy hot in the summer. I believe there was 3 days this summer where it got up to like 104, and we had to underclock our miners a little bit, but that was the most intense we saw. We launched the North Dakota container in negative 43 degrees Fahrenheit. And so like, in the cooler areas, you can do an air-cooled unit where you just have big fans and you're just moving the air throughout the container if it gets too hot outside. And we built software systems and SCADA systems that allow us to control those fans remotely and control the temperature remotely. Now, West Texas, that demands something different because it gets so hot down there. We're actually working on building a cooling immersion container design where we only feel comfortable moving into West Texas when we have this design perfected, because we don't think you'd be able to do an air-cooled unit in West Texas with the hardware we want to use without frying it because it gets too hot. So yes, depending on where you are geographically and what the climate is like in that particular geography, we do have to design the containers specifically for that climate.
Right. And what kind of maintenance let's take maybe North Dakota. Once the unit's up and running, I mean, is someone needing to be there all the time looking at it, or can you just remotely monitor it like you said? How does the maintenance kind of work?
Yeah, so that's one thing we had to prove to ourselves before we attempted to aggressively expand like we are now, is that we need to be able to control these containers remotely. We're going to hopefully be building a lot of these containers and dropping them off in many different locations across the country. So just from a logistics standpoint, it's not possible to be on site to maintain every single container at a certain scale. And so we had to build internal software that allows us to control everything in the container. So we like to control as much as we can. We built the power distribution units to take the voltage from our generators and distribute them to the miners. We're building our own sort of back-end SCADA system that operates with the APIs provided by the ASIC hardware manufacturer, so we can communicate with individual miners within the container to turn them off, turn them on, change their fan speed. So the maintenance that goes on the container on an ongoing basis is so we're dropping these off in oil fields, and typically oil fields have extensive relationships with contractors that work with generators, that work with other similar type of operations that have similar fan filters and things like that. So it's very minimal work. So we maybe have somebody go into the container once every 6 weeks, if that, maybe to change a filter. We use MicroBT's Watts miners, predominantly M20S's up to this point. We've had, luckily, knock on wood, we've only had one minor failure over the last year. The only thing that we've needed to change with the miners particularly is a couple PSUs and a couple fans. But that's something that you can easily train somebody, a contractor, to change out. It's pretty straightforward. We have cameras in the containers as well, so if somebody is going out to do maintenance, we can communicate with them on the phone as they're going through something, and it help walk them through if they need to fix something. But we've designed the containers to be touched as little as possible, again, because that's just the only way that we're going to be able to scale this if we actually achieve what we want to achieve.
Right, that makes sense. And you mentioned before about, I mean, there are some critics that talk about, you know, Bitcoin wasting energy. So I did a calculation once, I think it's roughly right. And I worked out it was kind of using about the same as a power as a 5 million person country. So like a Denmark type of thing. This was a couple of years ago, so it's probably more than that now. And I think it was like 1% of the world's energy, something like that, electricity use. You could look at that and say, wow, what a waste. But you're making kind of almost basically an opposite argument. You want to just kind of dig into that?
Yeah. So that, again, that's a huge point of contention for people outside of Bitcoin, looking at Bitcoin, seeing that it does consume a lot of energy, which, let's not deny that fact. Bitcoin consumes a lot of energy. That is a fact.
As does gold mining, by the way. So just for the gold bugs out there, to be very clear, gold uses a lot of energy too. So
as does gold mining, as does banking, all those buildings, all the headquarters of JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, they take up a lot of energy. The commute that their employees have to and from work takes up a lot of energy. Arguably the nature of the easy monetary system that the world's central banks are coordinating in tandem leads to a lot of waste and misallocation of capital, which leads to unnecessary energy consumption. There's, so I guess what we're getting at here is that there's a lot of logical inconsistencies when people point at Bitcoin and say this is bad because it's consuming a lot of energy, when you can literally point at any other industry and say the same thing. And it's like, well, you have to weigh the cost benefit analysis of the energy that is being consumed and the benefit is being provided by the technology that's consuming that energy. And I would say the cost benefit analysis really plays in Bitcoin's favor, and Bitcoin is a very positive EV on the world. It's immense. And when you get into the particular energy that Bitcoin is consuming, it actually makes it seem like Bitcoin is helping in a way, because you notice that Bitcoin is consuming a lot of renewable energies, whether it be hydroelectric, solar, and wind, or geothermal as well. A couple of years ago, CoinShares did a report and they estimated that renewable energy use by Bitcoin mining was at like 72%. So 72% of Bitcoin miners were using renewable energy sources. So yes, it's consuming a lot of energy, but a lot of that is renewable. I actually believe that number has come down since then. And particularly because of what's going on in with waste gas situations. And so then you dive into like, okay, Bitcoin is consuming some fossil fuels, but let's look into what's going on there. Like what we're doing at Great American Mining, we are going and taking gas that would otherwise be vented or flared. So venting methane into the atmosphere is 40 to 50 times worse than combusting the methane first and letting those emissions go to the atmosphere. So if you're venting, you're automatically doing the environment from an emissions perspective considerably worse damage. So if somebody's able to come up and cap that vent and combust that methane, that's a huge benefit to the environment off the bat. So Bitcoin, yes, is consuming that energy, but that energy would have otherwise been vented into the atmosphere. And it would be 40 to 50 times worse for the atmosphere than if it was run through our generators and used by Bitcoin. Flaring, similar thing. Flaring is taking that methane, combusting it, so it's worse for the atmosphere, but you're not getting any economic value out of it. And on top of that, flaring is not 100% foolproof due to wind. The amount of gas that's actually been being flared in that flare stack is not 100%. I think there's, depending on where you are in North Dakota, I think the efficiency of flare stacks is around like 30 to 50%. So half the gas going through that flare stack is actually essentially being vented. So if you're able to take that gas, instead of flaring it, running it through an EPA certified generator, you have a controlled burn of that methane. And so you know you're not losing any to the wind, you're not venting any of that out. So right there with what we're doing on the oil gas fields particularly, I think we're helping significantly and reduce the amount of overall emissions, which is great, number one. And then number two, we're turning that gas, which otherwise would have been wasted, literally just burned or flowed into the atmosphere and not turned into any economic value. We're taking that, we're turning it into economic value in the form of Bitcoin. And so you're taking that gas in this remote area, you're running it through a generator that's powering miners that are solving hashes that allow them to add blocks to the Bitcoin network. And you basically take that illiquid stranded energy source, you turn it into the most liquid digital good that's ever existed in the world, and you're able to send that anywhere in the world at a moment's notice, which is pretty crazy that you're taking this previously untapped natural resource that was arguably illiquid because it could be delivered to market, and you're making it something that's extremely liquid and can be sent around the world. Not the energy, but the token that's produced by consuming the energy. You're able to take that once illiquid energy source and turn it into the most liquid digital token that we have on the planet.
So that, I think that last part is really interesting, because if you, let's say you had a gold mine, just bear with me, right next to an oil and gas field. Or let's say there's an oil and gas field in seawater, and seawater does have, I think, 20 parts per billion of gold very consistently across the world. And we could get it out of the oceans, but, and all you need is energy. And if energy was cheap enough, it would be economic. Right now, it's basically not economic. But what's interesting is with Bitcoin, you're going from energy to basically dollars, like ridiculously quickly. I mean, at the end of the day, every 10 minutes, there's another block roughly. So every day you'll be mining some blocks and you'll be getting the rewards. And of course, you can instantly sell that on exchanges or whatever you want. Versus if you were doing this with kind of more traditional stuff, in the kind of gold example, you'd have all sorts of processing to do. It would take a long time and be much more costly.
I was going to say much more costly and actually much worse for the environment.
Right. Yes. Well, you're destroying the environment too. So.
Yeah, that you need to use mercury to sift or accumulate the gold. It's not good.
Yeah. And so I get it, is the reason you started with oil and gas, because at the end of the day, they're just wasting something that can, and so it should be kind of a fairly, well, okay, for someone that runs an oil and gas field that wants to do new things, and that is not going to be everyone, and someone that's maybe kind of a bit more technologically switched on, they may think, oh, this sounds pretty cool. Was it really just because at the end of the day, the gas being flared off is just wasted, or are there any other kind of important reasons why oil and gas? Because of course you could do this with, there are obviously miners everywhere in the world in incredibly sunny places with solar and, you know, as you said, near hydro, you know, depending on what's going on in China at any one moment, the miners in different parts of the country based upon how expensive the electricity is at different times of the year. So,
yeah, I mean, I think producers, it's actually been really interesting to watch play out over the last 6 months, particularly, or 7 months since the oil crash in March, when Saudi Arabia and Russia decided to not cut production and then eventually actually increase production as they were in a bit of a pissing match with each other, which really decimated the shale industry here in the United States, particularly due to the fact that that happened as we were going into lockdowns and the demand for oil and gas was collapsing pretty quickly as economies were shutting down around the world. OPEC sort of not caring about that at all and continuing production at the pace they were and then increasing it a little bit. Decimated this market. And so we found out in March that here in the United States, North America, Canada was affected as well, are very much beholden to the whims of the Saudis and other actors like the Russians in the global oil market realm. They can just increase production and really, and they can remain profitable at very low oil prices, and that's just not the case here in the shale play. As soon as you go below, I believe $33, a lot of the shale plays can start to go bankrupt. And so they're in a situation where they need to find a way to bolster their revenue as much as possible. And so we've seen individuals in the oil and gas industry over the course of the summer become more open to alternative revenue streams like Bitcoin mining. So it's a combination of, I would say, wise oil and gas industry opening their minds to using waste gas to mine Bitcoin. Number one, I would say, is because they're sort of desperate after what happened in March and are scrambling to find ways to stay afloat. A lot of smaller producers, particularly, even some of the bigger guys as well. And then number two, it's pretty blatantly obvious the amount of money that can be made once you actually have these Bitcoin mining operations deployed at scale. So once producers have their aha moment, it's like, holy crap, this is actually something meaningful and material that could improve our balance sheet and our revenue streams and inoculate us from the type of production games that are played on the global scale. So we have a thesis here again at Great American Mining that oil and gas industry players are actually going to become some of the largest Bitcoin miners in the world within the next decade, just because the opportunity that exists because of the amount of natural gas that exists in North America particularly. And we also believe that once these oil and gas producers become some of the largest miners in the world, United States, North America, as a continent, will be energy secure, where it won't have to worry about the changes in supply and production that the Saudis and the Russians force on the global markets.
Right. So that last point is super interesting too, right? Because I kind of had this crazy thought, and I'm sure it's not original of me, but the oil and gas industry, if this happens, could actually become the industry that lobbies most for Bitcoin, which most people think sounds totally insane. And that whilst they're not as powerful as perhaps they used to be, with maybe the tech industry now spending the most on lobbying, because, you know, often people talk about Bitcoin and say, well, oh, of course the government could just, you know, shut it down, which of course they can't just do, but they could kind of make it illegal. And, but I mean, if you've got a giant industry actually needing something, it seems to give like a few extra kind of layers of protection.
Yes. Yes. So that's another part of our thesis as well, is that, so it's multifaceted. Like, oil and gas producers will become some of the largest Bitcoin miners in the world. And so when they do that, they realize, because this is pretty capital intensive too, like to create a container that's consuming 1 megawatt of energy consistently, it's about $1 million. To build the container, get the miners.
It's kind of, it's also kind of crazy, right? You're putting a megawatt into a 40-foot container. It's kind of, I have a physics PhD, right? I understand power and stuff. That's kind of quite scary. So for those at home, like your average heater at home, if you live in a cold place, might be a couple of thousand watts, a couple of kilowatts. So it's 500 to 1,000 times more. It's a lot of heaters. That's why it gets hot.
Yeah, it's high density power consumption. That's one thing we talk about a lot, is these miners are very dense in the amount of power they can consume. It's actually pretty mind blowing. And you, once you like open up the container, you actually hear what's going on there. It's like not hard to believe that these machines are consuming that much energy just because of how loud they are.
And where does this all lead? I mean, my listeners will know from, I know a couple months ago, I did a podcast with Jeff Snyder on next generation reserve currencies. And we talked about all different ones, but one of the ideas that of course popped up was the concept of energy. And, you know, when the oil and gas companies become banks, there's no need for central banks. I always think a sufficiently advanced civilization, if you think more in what, like Isaac Asimov, someone that's hundreds of years ahead of us in the kind of tech tree of the universe, I doubt they'll be mucking around with fiat currency, to be honest. They're going to have something. I mean, it might not be like Bitcoin, but it could. But I mean, you said before, of course, you used to follow central banks, and you know, it feels like the US dollar is coming to the end of its reign as reserve currency. It could take 20, 30, 40 years for a transition. It tends to be long and slow. Even when there's catalysts, which in the past have been basically wars. But like, it seems like where it's going is you're going to get, when people are already mining Bitcoin everywhere, but in effect, people with solar panels on their roof or whatever could be doing this all over the place in a decentralized manner, i.e. everyone can create currency if this was the case. You think this is possible or just sort of a bit of a pipe dream?
No, I think it's not only possible, but it's been predicted by some very smart men in the past. Henry Ford, particularly, founder of Ford Motor Company, he wrote a op-ed in the New York Tribune in December of 1921, in which he stated that he wanted to move off a gold standard for the U.S. and move to an energy standard. Specifically saying that he believed that the world reserve currency should be denominated in 1 kilowatt hour of energy consumption. And he, at the time in 1921, so almost exactly 100 years ago, 99 years ago, Henry Ford had this idea. There's just no mechanism to actually bring it to fruition. And obviously Nikola Tesla bleed very much in energy as the currency of the world too. And then Buckminster Fuller is another individual who came by decades after Henry Ford and Nikola Tesla and basically said the same thing. He believed that the way to end all wars on Earth and to bring peace to Earth was to create a currency that could that was backed by energy. So there's many great men throughout history who've had this idea as energy being the backer of the global currency, and there's just been no mechanism to actually make it possible up to this point in time. There's no way to coordinate this energy currency globally due to the lack of technology that existed at the time when these gentlemen were alive. Now that Bitcoin is here, Bitcoin is basically the product that is fitting into that particular market that these gentlemen were thinking of. It is the first technology that is enabling the potential for the world to move to a global currency backed by energy. And it wasn't until Bitcoin came along and the technology progressed to where it is today that this idea that many great men throughout history have had was possible. So I think we are moving to a world reserve currency backed by energy in the form of a Bitcoin token. I completely agree. That's something we talk to oil and gas producers a lot. Like, you are going to be the central banks of the future, because if you think about the mechanics of a central bank now and the way money is created and distributed, it's distributed through the Fed window or something similar to it around the world, where the way money is created is the chairman at these banks decide, hey, we're going to purchase treasuries and we're going to create dollars to make that purchase, that asset purchase. And then those dollars flow through a Fed window that very few member banks have access to. So that's the way the money is distributed. The Fed takes those treasuries, creates dollars, gives it to the banks, who then hopefully lend it out. So it's there's very few people and entities included in that process, where if you extrapolate into the future and think about a world where Bitcoin is more widely dispersed, accepted, and used, the way Bitcoins are produced and distributed to the market is via mining. And the people who control those miners basically control what will be the new quote-unquote Fed window, or the new window at which monetary units are created and distributed to the rest of the market. So yeah, I completely agree. I think these large energy producers and even smaller ones will have a smaller part in it, but they will essentially be the new central banks that are distributing the currency to the rest of the market. And what's beautiful about that is that that this central bank window, quote unquote, gives access to many more people. Many more people have access to this central bank.
Right. And I think that the key effect there is called the Cantillon effect, that's been around for hundreds of years. That if you, as you said, when the Fed creates, well, they basically create bank reserves, which, and then only if the banks actually lend extra money, does extra money get created. But that's going to a very small group of people, and it doesn't trickle down very well. And this has been known about for hundreds of years, and is still true to this day. So this kind of leads us very neatly onto, well, you know what? Central banks are still there, and everyone's talking about central bank digital currencies. And these are not blockchains, they're centralized databases. But having said that, they could be programmable money. Is this a bridge towards the vision we've just laid out, or something that's very 1984 and George Orwell, very scary? I mean, because they're happening. I mean, I think the train's left the station. I mean, near to me in China, of course, there's already the most widespread testing of their one. But I mean, everyone from the ECB, the Fed, Bank of England, Reserve Bank of Australia, it's happening. So how does this all fit in? Because the central bankers aren't just going to kind of give in. That's for sure. So,
agreed. They're certainly not going to give in. It's funny. I had this conversation with a gentleman who was mentioned early in the podcast, Bitcoin Tina. He seems to be a believer of the latter scenario you laid out, in which central bank digital currencies could be a great on-ramp for Bitcoin. I'm actually more a believer in the former, that they are the core pillars of a digital panopticon that would help export the Chinese surveillance state to the rest of the world. I don't think the only difference between a central bank digital currency and the current monetary units that central banks control today is just the technology that allows people to access them. And arguably, with the digital wallets that these central banks are talking about creating and the granularity with which they can airdrop money and control the flow of money more particularly, I think it's becoming very evident that what they want to build is very dystopian and would hinder liberty and freedom of association, economic association, particularly.
Right. I mean, they're trying to make money non-fungible.
Yes.
Which by the way, sounds very innocent in some ways, but it actually, I mean, I'm with you that I totally get there could be interesting. It could be good for on-ramps, sure. But again, the world isn't just about Bitcoin, and making money non-fungible could be one of the most profound things that happens in our lifetime. You know, you can spend this $100 I've given you, but you've got to spend it at this local shop in the next 3 days. Oh, you've not fast enough. You need to spend it in the next 3 hours. We need inflation, else you lose it. This is where it's going. Hey, maybe it works out great, but it's a complex system. I seriously doubt having such centralized power is going to be, not going to get abused. So.
Exactly. It's like an extension of modern monetary theory too, where, like you just mentioned, what really irks me and makes me really dismayed about the state of the world, particularly the monetary system that the world runs on, is that you have very select few people trying to control a highly complex system that is a global economy. Like, you can't micromanage a complex system. It's just never going to work. And up to this point, the micromanagement has come in the form of QE and other similar policies that have been enacted that are really sort of wide net. I wouldn't even say wide net. They're actually pretty narrow in their application, where the Fed just buys a bunch of assets, gives them to banks, hoping that they'll lend them out. Where monetary theory and the ideas that are floating around central bank digital currencies just take that, noticing what the Fed has done with QE and other policies, saying, hey, they've done a lot, but that has not achieved the results we wanted. And to achieve the results we want, we need more granular control to direct the flow of the money we're creating to where we believe it needs to be. So you're taking this preponderance of the ability to control this complex system that has proven to fail up to this point, and they're saying, hey, we're just not able to get the money flowing to exactly where it needs to be. So we have this central bank digital currency in conjunction with a implementation of modern monetary theory, we'll be able to get the flow of capital where it needs to be going. And again, that's just hubris to the highest degree to think that more granular control over the flow of capital from the central bank digital currencies to individuals around the world is going to work. Again, you're going to be limiting the free flow of capital and freedom of association, like you laid out. Like, if you get airdropped a central bank digital currency and you're forced to spend it on certain goods at certain places, that's not really freedom. That's more control than authorities have ever had over humans at any point in human history, which is pretty crazy. It's very dystopian. It's not the future I want my children to live in. And that's why I'm aggressively attempting to integrate the Bitcoin mining industry with the oil and gas industry here in the United States as quickly as possible.
Right. So that's what I was going to get to. So how can Bitcoin, or this kind of Bitcoin energy kind of ecosystem, how can it compete? Like, what's the, because there are people listening who'll be like, okay, yeah, a lot of people listening are skeptics on central banks, but they'll just say, yeah, but at the end of the day, the government can decide how you're taxed. They've got all sorts of levers they can pull. They're never going to let go of power. You know, there's an argument on democracy that maybe younger generations, as they grow up, will vote out these types of policies. But again, people are very skeptical on democracy as well at the moment, just in general in the world. So does there have to be some like bottom up kind of groundswell? Because, you know, top down, i.e. governments are not going to just kind of flip the switch to the kind of Bitcoin system. So how practically do you think it could actually evolve over the next one or two decades?
I think it's happening. I think it's already evolving. I think it's, everything's going according to plan, as some Bitcoiners would like to say. Just the progression of the network, the amount of mind shared around the protocol, actually building the code out and reviewing the code and testing the code and building second layers, is pretty robust. There's a lot of publicly traded companies beginning to look at Bitcoin as a treasury asset. Obviously, we have MicroStrategy and Square most recently stepping into the market. We have senators here in the United States that are coming out as pro-Bitcoin and being Bitcoin advocates on Capitol Hill. We have a bunch of bullish fundamental indicators getting stronger and stronger by the day, which gives me confidence that Bitcoin will succeed into the future. And then on top of that, like, how does it compete with the central bank digital currencies? I mean, it's just the only truly free market on the face of the earth. If you have access to the protocol and you have the ability to access the internet to send a transaction, or access the satellite in the air to send a transaction, you can send that transaction, you can engage in free trade. And so, juxtaposed to these central bank digital currencies that are really only allowing you to spend your money in very specific places on very specific things, how does it compete with that? Well, it competes, like, it's a completely different animal than that central bank digital currency world, where you can actually engage in free trade under a Bitcoin standard, where arguably under a central bank digital currency standard, you would not be able to. And then on top of that, like, how does this succeed into the future? We are very focused on integrating the oil and gas industry, because again, the energy industry has the most leverage, right? At the end of the day, to get anything done in an economy, you need energy. And the producers in the United States, particularly at a time when we're trying to become energy independent and energy secure, have a lot of leverage. And we believe that if you're able to integrate Bitcoin mining operations, which again are very capital intensive, into their operations, then they're going to have a lot of capital outlaid into this particular asset class. And they're going to look at that and say, hey, I want to protect that investment. And they will stand up for Bitcoin on Capitol Hill. So I think the conjunction of just the mind share around the protocol, the legitimacy of Bitcoin, the token, in the eyes of the mainstream, particularly institutional money. It's on corporate balance sheets. You have politicians who are favorable towards Bitcoin entering the Senate here in the United States. And then just the natural game theoretical incentives built into the system. I strongly believe just inoculate, protect Bitcoin from any government attacks in the future. It's too distributed geographically now at this point, where any government that were to attempt to really shut down and ban Bitcoin would really be shooting itself in the foot. It could be a government or a contingency of governments, like UN governments, the EU governments, whatever it may be. They can try to come at and attack and ban Bitcoin, but I think the network is too robust and distributed from a geographical standpoint at this point that I find it hard to believe that these governments will successfully ban Bitcoin. They may certainly try, but I think it will be in vain if they do. And I'm not so convinced that they will try to ban it either. I think the situation they're in is pretty bad from a debt and a monetary system run awry. From that perspective, that actually Bitcoin may be viewed as a welcomed escape route from the corner that the global central bankers have walked themselves into.
Yeah, and that last point is interesting, because I mean, right now it's a $300 billion asset. So I mean, that's a lot of money, but it's many people would say, well, it's 21 million Bitcoins. It's not $300 billion, but it's tiny in the grand scheme of things still. But having said that, you know, a government could make it painful for citizens of their country and US, Australia have both sort of banned gold before. I mean, they didn't really ban it. You had to sell it in the US back to the government at the kind of market rate. But I've kind of always thought the threat was more important than the execution of such a kind of banning strategy. And to your point on game theory, like, unless everyone coordinates across the world, then there's going to be a lot of countries that want to get out of the US hegemony too. And they'll dive straight in. And you know, the network, as to your point, is still very incredibly strong. But I mean, is there really anything like a genuine superpower? Like if the US or China, let's just say they're the two world superpowers now, if their number one thing in life was to technically destroy Bitcoin, so not the fiat to crypto side, which is, you know, really for where they might actually probably have the most leverage, but could they really technically prevent it working? Or is that just something where the ship has sailed for that really to be possible?
Now, I don't want to say, I don't ever want to say anything's impossible, but I think it would be very, very hard. Again, so to shut down Bitcoin, these governments, let's use China and the US as the example in this case, you laid that out. I mean, they'd have to shut down the Bitcoin network. You have to do multiple things. You have to find every full node that you could possibly find, literally show up to those, to the places where these full nodes are being run and unplug them from a wall. Myself personally.
What, a few tens of thousand full nodes, is that right?
Yes. So there's, I believe, 11 to 12,000 quote unquote listening nodes that are public on the network. And there's some estimates between 60 and 90,000 nodes altogether when you include were considered non-listening nodes. Loop Dasher follows that stat. So around 12,000 listening nodes and potentially 90,000 nodes all in.
And for people listening that aren't familiar, like that could literally be your computer at home. I mean, it's a few hundred gigabytes in size, the entire Bitcoin blockchain. And so that's literally, and by the way, most people who are running these, they may not be, you know, they're going to be, you're not just going to be able to trace their IP address simply to where they are. Like, I mean, this is, you'd literally have to search every computer. Although maybe, I guess, you could have some like incredibly clever kind of virus thing that kind of makes them all kind of send a signal out. But I don't know. But that's the type of thing you'd have to do. So
yeah. And you have a lot of nodes running behind Tor and running through VPNs that sort of mask their location. So that is one way that you could kill, or you would have to. That's one thing you would have to do to kill the Bitcoin network, which is logistically a very hard problem to solve. Something that's probably easier to do, but still very hard, would be to attack mining. Chinese government could go to large mining farms in within their borders and force individuals to shut down, which would severely reduce hash rate on the network, slow down blocks, but due to the difficulty adjustment, that would eventually work itself out. Next thing they would do is attack mining pool operators, a lot of which are located within China's borders, and they could attempt to make the pool operators construct their blocks in a way that perturb the Bitcoin network, potentially mine empty blocks, reorg a bunch of times. But again, that's the beauty of Bitcoin. It's a truly free market, freedom of association. The individual miners within those pools could see that the pool was doing something nefarious and easily move to another pool outside of China's borders. So that attack vector, while probably more tangible than others, is pretty weak due to the freedom to opt out of that particular mining pool and point your hash rate at
right.
another.
I think that last point is really important and is really, really misunderstood. Because I think a lot of people have heard of 51% attacks and what could the Chinese government do? Oh, there's 70% or 60% of the mining in China. But I don't think a lot of people realize that this isn't just, to your point, a mining a lot of it's mining pools where I could be mining in my house, but I'm pooling it together, right, with a bunch of other people like me. It's not just physical machines located in a certain country. And I think what doesn't get talked about enough is that although people in the Bitcoin space get it, but it's such a dynamic network that everyone's going to know what's happening like very quickly. There'll be like a bazillion Twitter bots going off and things, and everyone's going to know. And like, you're going to have this global hive mind of just from the developers, the nodes, and the miners, and without any leader, it will, I have full confidence, it will like magically work itself out. Even though there's probably not a plan written down. It's kind of such is the power of like the decentralization of the network. It's kind of fascinating.
It's the power of the decentralization of the network. And I don't want to harp on this too much, but the incentives, the game theoretical incentives that exist between the stakeholders and Bitcoiners, beautiful. And again, the people, particularly mining, again, going back to the fact that it is a pretty large capital outlay, miners specifically are highly incentivized to work in the best interests of the network to remain profitable. It's a low margin business with a high initial capital outlay. So if anybody is messing with the mining aspect of Bitcoin via pools, whatever it may be, individual miners are going to act pretty quickly because they are very, very profit driven and very sensitive to the amount of money they're making on a daily basis. So they will act quickly.
One interesting thing too is a few weeks ago, this wasn't picked up that widely that I saw, but it was mentioned by a few people. But I know I had people in Hong Kong telling me about it. There was a period a few weeks ago where for several days there was all the media in China, which is obviously controlled by the state, was talking about how Bitcoin's the best investment of the year in terms of how much it's up, in terms of the kind of macro asset classes. And this was kind of an odd thing in some ways. But it was really interesting because this was exactly when the number of new addresses per day just kind of, it's normally about, was it 5,000 extra day? I can't remember, but it basically bumped up exactly the same time. And of course you don't know where the addresses are, but it was probably just due to extra activity in China. And then I kind of, you know, if you put on your kind of, again, game theory hat, it's like, well, China's probably worked out they could become the largest owner of Bitcoin. Maybe they tax miners they tax them in Bitcoin. You know, you've got, was it Iran recently, you know, at a kind of more state level trying to get into this. It's all part of that game theory that you alluded to. So, I mean, I have no idea if what I just said is what will happen, but it's just kind of interesting. And nothing happens by accident in China, so that's for sure. So.
China's very... So somebody's very into mining, China blows my mind because you have this weird dichotomy of the Chinese Communist Party, which is arguably one of the most authoritarian regimes in the world, forcing communism on the people of China. But then you look, there's like some capitalistic tendencies within China too. Like there was something particularly about the Bitcoin mining industry within China. They were the innovators. Like you have Bitmain, MicroBT creating the best hardware for Bitcoin mining. You have the largest amount of hash rate, the largest amount of Bitcoin mining pools in China. Yes, it's getting more distributed, but despite the fact that China is a communist country, the innovation in the Bitcoin mining world, specifically that's come out of China, has been mind-blowing. And the Chinese entrepreneurs in the Bitcoin mining industry are some of the most cunning and innovative that I've come across in my short time on this planet. But it's interesting to note, like we've spoken with Chinese miners who have large farms and they want to co-locate their mining equipment outside of China's borders because they're afraid of the CCP clamping down on this. And so even individual miners within China are worried about the CCP and are actively looking to co-locate their hardware outside of Chinese borders so that they can diversify their risk a bit geographically. But yeah, to your point, like I wouldn't be surprised if China holds a lot of Bitcoin already. I mean, the amount, just the way the Bitcoin supply schedule works, it's very front heavy. We had half of Bitcoin that will ever exist mined in the first 4 years. And we have, what, 18.67 million distributed to the market already, a little over 2.5 million left to be mined. And arguably most of the Bitcoin that's been mined to date was via hash rate that had existed in China or on a pool that operates in China. So it wouldn't surprise me if they actually own a lot more.
Right, exactly. I think they've realized it's just, it could become a very important strategic asset. Not certain to, but it could. And if it does, why not own a bunch?
I think it already is. Like you mentioned Iran. Iran's central bank, again, forced into a corner via sanctions. They have no ability to buy imports without Bitcoin, it seems. Like they're forcing individuals who are using state-run energy sources to mine Bitcoin to sell that Bitcoin to the central bank so that the state can then buy imports and get goods brought into the country. It is becoming a necessity for some people already.
Yeah, nice. Kind of crazy times. Cool. Well, we've covered a lot. And just, I wanted to pick your brain though, like very quickly. Like, so I kind of jokingly said once that after energy, there's only kind of that there's one ultimate reserve currency, which would be time. And, you know, if you could kind of tame enough energy, you can actually slow down time, according to Einstein. Yeah. And in fact, if I'm moving relative to you, my time is actually going more slowly just by a tiny, tiny, weeny fraction that we can measure. So it's just something you said earlier, piqued my mind on that because, you know, energy, going back to what Henry Ford said, it's the second most ultimate kind of currency. The most ultimate, the one thing we can never get more of is time. So, but this might be, you know, that could be 10,000 years in the future. So probably not next week.
Yeah, well, I studied economics, not physics, so I can't speak to the relativity of time and actually the function of slowing or quickening time. From a physics standpoint, I'm not smart enough to do that, but I can say that if we move to a world reserve currency that is Bitcoin, and you move to a Bitcoin standard that brings a sound monetary standard back to the world, you're going to have a lot more time than you would have if we perpetuate the system that we live under now, where, again, going back to the Cantillon effect, the nature of an inflationary currency that basically erodes your time, your stored time in the form of savings. You're basically getting that stolen from you as these governments inflate away their currencies on a daily basis. So you're having your time stolen for you that way. And if you revert to a sound monetary system in which you have less misallocation of capital and you're able to store your time in a monetary good that is not debased, arguably you will not have to work as much. You'll be able to save more, and then you'll be able to free up more time to do things that you want to do instead of going to a monotonous 9-to-5, pushing Excel spreadsheets just to get a paycheck so you can survive.
Yeah, absolutely. The one thing I think everyone always wants is more time. So yeah, that could actually be one of the more powerful aspects that doesn't get talked about enough. Good stuff.
Yeah, so, I mean, Bitcoin respects your time. Yeah. Like the sound money respects your time more than unsound money, which a lot of people don't understand. You're getting your time and your stored time in the form of savings, more importantly, stolen from you as these currencies are debased.
Yeah. And I think it's probably fair to say that, I don't think there are going to be many politicians in the next 10, 20 years that are going to take the tough decisions on them and not debase currencies. There might be some countries that don't, but the main ones, the usual people around the table are seem to be pretty hell-bent. Good stuff. All right. So, Marty, how can people learn more about you? So what's the best way? Is it Twitter or probably your daily blog, or what are the best ways?
Yeah, so Twitter.
Also, how do they learn more about Great American Mining? Because I think you mentioned to me before the website's going to get updated, and I just think it's super cool, and everyone should, check it out.
So Great American Mining We're on Twitter there, at gam.ai. That's GAMDOTAI. That's our handle there. As you mentioned, we are redesigning our website with more content. We just have a landing page now. Hopefully we'll have that launched next week, but you can still go check it out to see a video of one of our containers at gam.ai, GAM.ai in your browser. I hang out a lot on Twitter at Marty Bent. All my content can be found on my website, which is tftc.io. And if you want to sign up for the newsletter, you can do so there. And yeah, feel free to reach out, ask me any questions. I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. It's a great way to start my morning.
Cool. Thank you. And again, guys, check out Marty's podcast, Tales from the Crypt, every week. Massive variation in topics. Sometimes goes on and his co-host on long rants on certain things, other times not, but it's great listening. And sometimes it does get more technical, and that's fine. Like, there's a rabbit hole here that I know a lot of listeners have already jumped in. And I think everyone will ultimately have to jump in, whether they want to or not. But, you know, so get ahead of the curve. So the amount of free resources out there on Bitcoin and blockchain is incredible. So so definitely recommend Tales from the Crypt. Cool. Well, thanks very much for your time, Marty. And best of luck with, with the oil and gas industry. I think it's awesome. So, yeah.
Well, thank you for having me, Chris. I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. Appreciate you having me on, and keep crushing it.